Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's visit today to Cedar Falls, Iowa, where he encouraged the building of municipal broadband networks, as was done 20 years ago in this small rural city of 40,000, whose residents enjoy 1 gigabit per second broadband, the fastest in the country, comparable to households and businesses in South Korea, Japan, and France. Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, joins us to discuss Obama's efforts to stop cable and telecom monopolies from pushing state laws to prevent competition while the cable and phone companies continue to charge more and more for poorer and much slower internet service than the rest of the industrial world has. Then we'll take a broader look at the media landscape with Victor Picard, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and The Future of Media Reform. We'll look back at efforts to maintain the public interest in and influence over the public airwaves that has been rolled back since President Reagan ended the FCC's Fairness Doctrine in 1987, and discuss how citizens can reassert control over the public airwaves to be better informed and educated, as opposed to being passive consumers of advertising and infotainment. Then finally, we will look into the Regulatory Accountability Act passed Tuesday by the Republican House that modifies the Administrative Procedures Act, which has been in existence for 60 years. Sidney Shapiro, the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University, joins us to discuss this effort to undermine the entire U.S. regulatory system over financial and consumer product protections, public and worker health and safety, and environmental protection, by making it easier for corporations to challenge and delay new rules by creating some 74 new procedures and requirements meant to gum up the works of government agencies with layers and layers of extra paperwork. And joining us now is Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. A leading national expert on community broadband networks, he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse of information about community broadband. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Mitchell.
Thank you.
And you're in Iowa, where today in Cedar Falls, Iowa, President Obama announced his support for municipal broadband. And I take it that Iowa's Republican Governor Terry Branstad is also on board with this.
You know, that's a good question. I don't know the Iowa governor's exact position on it. He certainly is in favor of expanding broadband access, although he's been in office for such a short period of time, I'm not sure what his position is on municipal broadband. But after the event, we know for sure where the president stands on it, and that is fully with the right of cities to build their own networks if they want to.
So tell us about that. What happened today. Did you meet with Obama?
Well, at the end, I did shake his hand. I was in the rope line, so I was able to just shake his hand after he was done with the presentation.
And what was his presentation?
Today, he spoke about the ways that he thinks the country can improve internet access. And so he came to Cedar Falls, which about 20 years ago built its own broadband network. And the president basically said that was a very smart idea. And he noted that Cedar Falls now has one of the fastest networks in the nation, and that a number of states, about 20 states, limit local authority to build those networks. And so among other things that the White House will be doing to try and expand internet access, they're going to try and remove those states that will not let their cities do what Cedar Falls has done.
And the reason these states don't allow municipalities to build their own municipal broadband and high-speed broadband, much of it is 1 gigabit per second, broadband, which is common in South Korea, Japan, and even France, but extremely rare in the United States, is because the monopolies, the telecom and cable monopolies, preemptively sue, do they not, to prevent municipalities from building out their own broadband networks?
The big companies, they really do engage in lawsuits, and they also will try and pass laws. They do a lot of lobbying at both the federal and the state level to try and limit local authority to build these networks. So the answer is basically the cable monopolies, as you said. These are not official monopolies. They're just monopolies because they're so powerful, it's very hard to compete with them. They try to limit competition by making sure that city governments cannot build their own networks, even if those monopolies are not doing a good job.
So how come Cedar Falls, Iowa, what a town of about 40,000 people, has the best broadband in the country?
Well, they built this cable network about 20 years ago because they were not happy with the services they were getting from their existing provider, a private national cable company. And over the years, they upgraded it. And so they started offering a basic broadband. And they've done so well, so many people in town, so many businesses have subscribed to them, that they were able to pay down their bills ahead of time. And they decided to put some of that money into upgrading the network to a fiber-to-the-home network. So, you know, right now, most Americans have access to a cable network, which is an older technology. But cities like Chattanooga, Lafayette, Louisiana, and Cedar Falls, Iowa, have fiber optic networks that go to everyone's home. And Cedar Falls basically decided to put some of this money they've generated from their cable network, you know, into upgrading to this super fast technology. This is something that a number of cities across the United States are doing, and it's also something that companies like Google are doing.
So what is the reason why the telecoms and the cable monopolies don't provide similar service?
Well, if you have a business where you don't really have to worry too much about what your customers think of your product because you're the only game in town, or because there's only one other game in town and you guys kind of work together to set prices and you're happy with how you split up the market, then you don't have to put millions of dollars into better networks to deliver better services. And that's effectively the situation in most American communities. If you or I wanted to try and build a really great broadband network in one of these cities, you'd rapidly find that the cable prices dropped, because as soon as there's a threat of competition, the existing cable providers will then drop their very high prices. And then that means that you and I, as business people, would not be able to make enough money to justify the investment. And that's why we see cities doing this, because cities can wait out longer. Cities can take 5-7 years to break even and then make a profit on these networks. Whereas a small business that you or I might form, you know, we would not be able to just go up against Comcast, because we'd have to start making money in the second or third year.
Well, Fios, the Verizon plan, did lay cable, laid fiber optics, but then Wall Street pressured Verizon to get rid of the CEO that had come up with this Fios, because they thought he was spending too much money and it was too long term, the payback. And of course, ironically, Fios is the most profitable part of Verizon's business. So, you know, I guess that your point's well taken, that we're talking about monopolies here, government protected monopolies. They don't have to perform in the capitalist system. And
well, I would, if you don't mind, I'll just, it's a common misconception that there are government protected monopolies, but since 1996, it's been federal policy is that you cannot have an official monopoly. And so the fact that we still have these monopolies is more because the government has not broken them up, as opposed to because the government has given them some sort of official status. And then the Fios point, you're absolutely correct in terms of Fios. Verizon built this fiber optic network out. Although from our point of view at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, the problem with Fios is that they were unimaginative. They're a big national company, and they basically just decided to try and do what the cable company was doing, rather than using this incredible network to do what Google and small companies and municipalities are doing, which is to deliver really fast internet service at affordable prices.
Again, I'm speaking with Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. A leading expert on community broadband networks, he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse of information about community broadband. And he's in Cedar Falls, Iowa, where he met with the president today. And the president announced his support for municipal broadband. This is the shame of it. I mean, here we are in a country that invented the internet, and the average speed of internet in the United States for consumers is 9 megabits per second. And this small city in Iowa Cedar Falls provide 1 gigabit per second, that's a thousand megabit per second, to their customers. And Chattanooga does the same. And I think you said Lafayette, Louisiana, a few municipalities do it. But just the difference,
that's right, yeah.
Difference between 9, the average in America, and 1,000 ought to take the scales off people's eyes and realize how, as a country, we're being incredibly shortchanged by this extraordinary technology.
Well, that is, I mean, in some ways, it's actually inspiring, I think, that you can have a town like Cedar Falls that's one of the leading cities in the country on this, because they've decided to be self-reliant and be very smart with their investments. But I just want to, a number of these cities, you can get a gigabit, but it's not default that everyone gets that. Many people, like in Chattanooga, many people, you know, they'll only have 100 megabits, and if they don't want to pay for the gigabit. So, you know, they're only 10 times faster than the average person, not 100 times. And in Cedar Falls, their intro tier is faster than the average cable, but it just so people are aware, the gigabit does cost a little bit more here in Cedar Falls than in some other place. But it is available to every last person and every last business. And the president today was introduced by a local business which has been able to thrive in part because of this internet access that the city provides.
Well, we have here in Los Angeles a similar situation in Santa Monica, where they've put in high-speed broadband and attracted businesses from all around the world. What is the business attraction? I mean, off the top of my head, it would seem to me that this would be a vast boon for hospitals and for pretty much any business, for education, for colleges and schools, because you could be delivering so much information so fast.
Yes, that's you really named the biggest beneficiaries. It's often schools, healthcare, and that sort of thing. The other beneficiaries often are smaller businesses. You know, very large businesses will often already have decent access. They're not just buying a cable connection for their facilities. They're already doing something that's unique to them. But small and medium businesses in a place like Santa Monica have much greater options than they would outside of Santa Monica. And so I think it's just important to recognize that these have different impacts. And one of the things that Cedar Falls did here was to connect all the schools. And they're looking at how they can figure out how to connect more schools in the region as well.
So how is the president, making a speech in Iowa? Man, I imagine a lot of American people don't know about how shortchanged they are in terms of availability to this technology that is ubiquitous in South Korea, Japan, and France and other countries for a much, much lower cost. I mean, we're all getting hosed by the cable and telecom monopolies who charge us more and more for less and less service. That seems to be their business model. How's the president going to break through these monopolies, and what specifically did he propose that could be done to encourage the proliferation of municipal broadband?
Well, he has a fact sheet that if people want to search around for, they can really get the specific policy prescriptions. But some of the ones are already, like I said, knocking down some of the barriers where cities are not allowed to do it. Another thing is that if a city's getting money to build some fiber or some communications infrastructure for a different project that's not related to providing internet to businesses, then I think we're going to see that money, that those assets could also be used for other purposes. So when Santa Monica was connecting a bunch of its traffic signals to make them smarter and to improve the flow of traffic, it wasn't clear when other cities do that if they could also put in extra fiber optics and conduit at the same time. So I think when the federal government is funding these sorts of projects, they're going to be directed to find ways that they can get a real multiplier benefit out of doing them. And right now there's some lack of clarity. And then another thing that he noted was, perhaps more importantly, was he's going to be convening a group of people at the White House to look at these sorts of strategies. And something that I think we've often seen is that communities are interested about doing this, but they're not sure where they can get good, unbiased information. They're not sure how to connect with other people that have done it, which is something that I try to help out with. But the federal government is going to be doing more convenings to try and help people, local leaders, to work together. And then let me just note that he did name check Next Century Cities, an organization that we launched in Santa Monica, which is a very exciting collaboration of mayors from around the country. We're just about 4 months old now. I've been helping out with it from within my position at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And Next Century Cities is something that is also helping cities to share strategies and figure out how to, they can supercharge the deployment of really great networks.
And what did the president talk about the looming FCC decision on net neutrality, and what is the role of the FCC in helping expand broadband access through municipal broadband?
Well, the chairman of the FCC has been a real champion of competition and municipal networks. And the White House is submitting a comment to the FCC regarding two petitions that are in front of the FCC right now. The states of North Carolina and Tennessee both restrict local governments. And those local governments, in the case of North Carolina, Wilson, North Carolina, in the case of Tennessee, Chattanooga, the two cities have filed requests to the FCC that they remove the state laws that are prohibiting them from expanding their existing networks to nearby towns. And the president said that he supports that. On network neutrality, the president did not say much. He said that he's already unveiled his network neutrality wishes, that he wants to make sure that the internet remains open and free, and that it continues to operate in the same way that it has historically. That was all he really said about that in this case. And he just went right into talking about jobs and municipal networks.
But what can the president do with a Congress that's hostile and now controlled by the Republicans? And they, in the last few days, have just been giving away the store to Wall Street and to corporate America in terms of getting rid of all as many regulations as they can. And so presumably the Republicans are champions, even though they talk about free enterprise, they're champions of protecting monopolies, and anybody who funds their campaigns, and I imagine that would be Time Warner, Verizon, AT&T, et cetera. So,
You're asking a very good question. And I'll just start by noting that the cable companies do give a lot of money to Democrats as well. And President Obama himself is very close with people high up in Comcast. But in this case, it's very clear that the president and we've seen others in Congress take a real leadership role in terms of saying we need to make sure communities have this fundamental ability to build a network if they need to, if they want to. So I think the interesting question is really not so much between Democrats and Republicans in Washington, D.C. It's between Republicans in Washington, D.C. and Republicans around the rest of the country, because the president actually noted one of the cities that I researched, which was Yuma. It's also a county and a city in Colorado. They voted overwhelmingly in favor of municipal broadband this year, in the most recent election, because Colorado requires a referendum. And as the president said, those people voted 85% for Republicans. And so we see that the Republican grassroots, like the Democrat grassroots, like the independent grassroots, all support these decisions being made locally. It's a local issue. But at the federal level, you're right. We do see Republicans often taking the side of the telecom companies. You know, in the House, it couldn't get worse than Representative Marsha Blackburn, who is just, you know, she's so in favor of everything that the big telecom companies want. So I'm not sure what we're going to see the Republican leadership do. But if they're going to oppose the president on this, then they're also really going against their own grassroots in a lot of places.
Well, that's why I asked you about Governor Terry Branstad, because he's the Republican governor, but he's been pushing for access to broadband because his state is obviously a rural one with little to no access to the internet. So there's an example of grassroots Republicans wanting high-speed broadband.
Yes.
And why not?
Yes, and one of the things that we see is that, you know, historically, the federal government has been incredibly important when it comes to building infrastructure in rural areas. I think wisely when it's working with rural cooperatives. And right now, I think it'll be interesting to see whether or not Republicans in federal office will be willing to help use the power of the federal government to enable these rural cooperatives, which is a structure that historically Republicans have liked. But there's such this feeling among a certain set of Republicans that they hate everything about the federal government, and they don't want to admit that it does anything well. So I'm watching closely to try and see what we're going to get out of this Congress. But I have a hope that some of these Republicans will recognize that this is an agreed upon principle, is that, you know, co-ops in rural areas are a good thing. And if the federal government can help them expand infrastructure, then that is a very wise use of taxpayer dollars when it's done smartly.
Well, Christopher Mitchell, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Christopher Mitchell, the director of the Community Broadband Networks Initiative at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. A leading national expert on community broadband networks, he runs muninetworks.org, the comprehensive online clearinghouse of information about community broadband. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back looking into how the public can reassert public control over the public's airwaves. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Victor Picard, a professor at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he explores the history of and political economy of media institutions, media activism, and the politics of media policy. He's been a senior research fellow at Free Press and the New America Foundation, and with Robert McChesney, he co-edited Will the Last Reporter Please Turn Out the Lights? His latest book just out is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Victor Picard.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And we were just talking to somebody who works in trying to proliferate municipal broadband. And the president, of course, spoke today in Cedar Falls, Iowa, where they do have 1 gigabit per second municipal broadband for that town. But, of course, across the country, these telecoms monopolies and cable monopolies have been suing to preempt even that choice. So what happened to America? You're an historian of American media and our media democracy. Has this rollback away from the media as a public utility into it as a profit center for monopolies who charge more and more and deliver less and less service? Is that the trend line we're on?
Yes, it seems that way historically, and that's what I try to figure out in my research, trying to figure out how did we inherit this particular kind of media system, one that is dominated by a handful of monopolistic corporations. And I trace the answers to this question back to media policy battles, really, that took place in the 1940s when, of course, at that time it was about radio. American society was trying to figure out what is the role of radio in a democracy? How should the government try to manage this media system, and should we let it be dominated by monopolies? I think we know how this story ends, but I think it provides us with some instructive parallels when we look at this history.
Well, one of the things though that came out of that period that I think was extremely useful, and it sort of dampened down the kind of poisonous speech that you now have on radio with you know, active propaganda outlets like Fox News and their sort of left-wing equivalent, MSNBC, where they used to have a thing called the Fairness Doctrine, And I remember years ago, Haskell Wexler and I made a documentary about the nuclear arms race called War Without Winners. And because of the Committee on the Present Danger, led by Paul Wolfowitz, were proliferating their hysterical, "The Russians Are Coming" film across American television, warning against telling the American people that the Russians had these huge missiles and we had puny little ones. And they were working essentially on Ronald Reagan's campaign. And he of course, got elected. And the first thing that Ronald Reagan did was to get rid of the fairness doctrine and, of course, spend a fortune on a military buildup. So the beauty of the fairness doctrine, from my personal point of view, was that we got our movie shown all over the country. Every time the Wolfowitz, you know, the Russians Are Coming movie was shown to scare people into voting for Reagan, at least they showed our film.
Yes, it was a meaningful public interest obligation that came out of the 40s, although there was this historical irony in that when it was passed in 1949, and it wasn't initially called the Fairness Doctrine, we began referring to this as the Fairness Doctrine later, sometime later, but it was seen as a consolation prize, actually, to reformers at that time, replacing what had been a more strict structural regulation. So it was at the tail end of this decade where, at the beginning of the decade, they were actually trust-busting radio monopolies. And by the end of the decade, they were placing these weaker regulatory guidelines on them, which nonetheless, to use the Fairness Doctrine as an example, it was used to varying degrees of success by activists on the left and the right for the ensuing decades. Until Reagan's FCC chairman, Mark Fowler, revoked it in 1987.
Well, I talked also to Richard Viguerie, a right-wing activist, and he said that the getting rid of the Fairness Doctrine was one of the best things that happened to the Republican Party and the right wing of the Republican Party, and that they were ready to hit the ground running when it was killed in 1987. And that led directly to Rush Limbaugh and the proliferation of all of this right-wing hate speech on television and on radio. Do you see a direct connection and the fact that the liberals were slow out of the gate?
I think it's a fair assessment, but the one thing I would point out is that in 87, when it was repealed, you had conservatives like then Representative Newt Gingrich, who were ready to actually legislate it, who actually wanted to save the Fairness Doctrine. So there's been an interesting shift where at one point you at least had some conservatives who saw value in having this tool with which the public could try to pressure broadcasters to present a balanced discussion on important social issues. It was always much more than more progressive than an equal time rule, which is often what people conflate it with. It's often misunderstood. It was this affirmative duty that broadcasters had to be accountable to local communities, and they had to cover important, even controversial issues in a balanced manner by providing diverse views and voices. But now, of course, there's been such a shift in the discourse that anything that's mildly affirmative that comes out of the FCC, it's immediately tainted by conservative activists as a backdoor fairness doctrine, or you might hear a fairness doctrine 2.0, or some activists tried to equate net neutrality as a fairness doctrine for the internet and various absurdities. So it won't zombie-like. It keeps coming back in our discourse. It won't ever die. But it's really interesting how the meaning of it has shifted over the decades.
Again, I'm speaking with Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he explores the history and political economy of media, media institutions, media activism, and the politics of media policy. His latest book just out is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. But I think it's had an enormous effect, the right-wing propaganda machines that have dominated the media since the Fairness Doctrine was revoked. An example is here in Southern California, the so-called Inland Empire, Riverside, San Bernardino, they always used to be represented by Democratic congresspeople, and now they're solidly Republican. And a lot of analysts have suggested the main reason is that everybody in those communities commute for hours on end and are stuck in their cars listening to Limbo and all of his clones.
It's true that when the Fairness Doctrine was in effect, you could not have a broadcaster air all this, or at least you had the potential tool to prevent a broadcaster from airing one side 24 hours a day. So it was never, some people thought, like a particular, the arguments against it, like when Rush Limbaugh had his campaign, Don't Hush Rush, when he was trying to make sure that the Fairness Doctrine was not brought into law, it was never something where the government could force a programmer, a broadcaster to bring in, during a particular show, another voice. But it's just this idea that you had to have balanced programming throughout the day. And there are studies that show there are these connections, certainly between the proliferation of right-wing talk radio and the loss of the Fairness Doctrine. But I probably come down, I definitely see value in the Fairness Doctrine, particularly the broader principle that it was trying to, this idea that broadcasters who use the public airwaves need to give the public, give society a return on this monopolistic use of a public resource. It was a kind of social contract. But beyond that, I think that it was somewhat of a symptom of a bigger problem, and that is, again, going back to these monopolistic issues, these structural problems where there's not diversity in ownership, there's not structural diversity of the kinds of media that we have access to. So that's where I, in my analysis, I would focus more on these broader structural problems.
Well, Victor, I do think you can make a fair case, though, that since the Fairness Doctrine was ended under President Reagan, not only has the right-wing dominated, certainly talk radio, and Fox, of course, is the most successful of the television cable networks, new so-called news networks, but I think it's also contributed, has it not, to the poisoning of our polity and our political discourse. It's no, we now you have the Democrats tend to be further and further to the left because they come from safe seats. They've been gerrymandered out of existence by and large. And then on the Republican side, you see the enormous influence of the Tea Party. And your fathers and grandfathers, Republican is an endangered species, an extinct species, as a matter of fact. Can you attribute that to the Fairness Doctrine or the end of it?
So there is raging debate on this particular issue, or I should say the more general issue of media effects and what can we attribute in society back to media. There's no question that there are relationships here. It's really hard to pin down what exactly is driving, like what the causal relationship is. But certainly I think you could point to, there have been studies, for example, that show that countries that have stronger public media systems tend to have better informed populations. So looking at sort of comparative analysis between European countries that subsidize a public media system and then the United States that has a very weak public media system dominated by privately owned institutions. So I do think you can, the research does show that there are these broader relationships. Whether I would pinpoint all of it, trace it all back to the loss of the Fairness Doctrine, I'm not sure. I think that's an open, debatable question. But certainly the broader trajectory that I think you're getting at is absolutely true, which is there's been this erosion of public service regulation in the United States. What came out of the 40s was already weaker than what the Social Democrats of the New Deal coalition were trying to advance. Going back to the history I cover in my book, the FCC actually broke up NBC in the early 40s. Imagine the FCC today trying to break up Verizon. So there's been this longer trajectory that shows a regulatory retreat, at least in terms of public interest obligations for broadcasters and for our media system in general.
Yeah, I agree with you probably that it certainly can't attribute everything to the ending of the Fairness Doctrine. And prior to that, of course, there has not been in the U.S. media the kind of public space that the BBC occupies in England. And of course, they're politically insulated because they're funded by, every time people buy a TV or a radio, they pay a license fee. And Nixon set up the public broadcasting, the PBS network, to fail and to be dependent upon Mobil Oil and their other sponsors. And now you have more ads on public television than you do on commercial television. And NPR is always looking over its shoulder at its government funders and who's in charge of the Congress. So we don't have, I mean, essentially from what I can tell, the only reason we have any decent news and information is because a few people like Bill Paley, the founder of CBS, had a kind of sense of social responsibility. There's nothing in the law, is there, to stop these media owners from broadcasting wall-to-wall commercials and having absolutely nothing but infotainment and no news.
There are only weak public interest obligations that remain today, just to, you know, vestiges. But I agree with you that some of it might be attributed to the good conscience of particular media owners. But I think more of it, I mean, even in the case of CBS, I mean, that was one of the, what came out of the 40s was that at the very least they were sensitized somewhat to this idea that if they didn't at least pay some tribute to this idea of the public interest of social responsibility, that they might at some point down the road become more closely regulated by the government. But they pretty much decisively won the policy battles throughout the 40s. And of course, you didn't get, I mean, there were one shining example that came out of the 40s was Pacifica. That's an alternative model that was founded in the late 40s. And, you know, I think you could argue, I don't think we could have ever had a huge, our entire radio system based on a Pacifica-like model, but we were closer. It was a lot more contingent than many Americans are aware of. Even in the early 30s, there was a debate about having 25% of the frequencies devoted to educational broadcast, or at least nonprofit, non-commercial broadcasting. So we were much closer to a BBC-like model than most Americans are aware of. But of course, today we're the global outlier in how little we pay for our public media. It's something like $1.50 per capita per year, whereas in Scandinavian countries, it's well over $200 per person. So we're, compared to other democratic countries, we are this outlier. There's this kind of American exceptionalism at work.
Well, of course, and I'm broadcasting out of KPFK in Los Angeles, a Pacifica station, and you know,
right,
it's the model that Lou Hill, the founder of Pacifica, came up with in the early 1950s was a that became the model for public radio, which is the public pay for what they like, and there's no overhead, no infrastructure, and it's a simple system that lasted a long time until, believe it or not, these lunatics at Pacifica created a governance system that is bankrupting the entire network. And, you know, it's a huge tragedy that here we are, the healthiest of the Pacifica stations, and, you know, we're having trouble making payroll. It's unbelievable. A commentary on the idiocy of the American left.
And Lou Hill was very much influenced by this initiative known as the FCC Blue Book in the mid-40s, which is trying to carve out this non-commercial, non-profit space within the broader radio system. But I agree with you, and you mentioned earlier PBS, NPR. I mean, there's this corporate encroachment. These models are always structurally vulnerable, and we just tend to defund our public media in the United States, and that's a problem. Ideally, that's something we would change.
But just in general, is there any way that we can have a reassertion of the fact that the public own the public airwaves, even though it's been all but lost?
I think it can be reasserted, perhaps not in the same way, although I do think it's important to always remind people, although it sounds like this slogan, but it's absolutely true that the air belongs to the people. These are the public airwaves. And that is a foundation for a kind of social contract. But I would like to broaden that debate to talk about just public media in general, the idea that public media are a public good. There is a public good nature of our news media that as a democratic society, we need to find ways to support, even if the market doesn't. And really, the market will never support. This is what I argue in the conclusion of my book, that there's always systemic market failure at work, that a commercial media system will never provide democratic society with adequate communication to satisfy its communication needs. So to counteract that, we need a public media system, and this should include everything from public radio, what we used to call public broadcasting, but also nonprofit newspapers, community and municipal-owned broadband networks. And I think as journalism implodes, and as we face the realities of these of the very negative situation that we're in with our internet service, our internet services, whether we're talking about net neutrality or the ongoing digital divide, this creates openings for the public to engage with these issues. And as a society, we should try to create a more public media system.
Well, Victor Picard, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I really enjoyed the show.
And again, I've been speaking with Victor Picard, who's a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication at the University of Pennsylvania, where he explores the history and political economy of media institutions, media activism, and the politics of media policy. His latest book just out is America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and the Future of Media Reform. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the House Republicans' efforts to destroy the entire U.S. regulatory system. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sidney Shapiro, the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University, one of the country's leading experts in administrative procedure and regulatory policy. He has written 10 books and has been a consultant to government agencies and has testified before Congress on regulatory subjects. He was a trial attorney with the Federal Trade Commission and Deputy Legal Counsel of the Secretary's Review Panel at the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sidney Shapiro.
Well, thank you, and good evening.
And the Republican Congress is moving very quickly out of the gate. One of the first things they did was change the way that the government measures the impact of tax cuts on federal revenues, literally a war on mathematics, so that they can give tax breaks to their wealthy backers and they don't have to talk about the impact on the deficit, which, of course, they're all deficit hawks to begin with. And then on Tuesday, they came up with a new way to basically get rid of government rules that have been in existence for 60 years by modifying the Administrative Procedures Act. And just today, they approved a whole bunch of new perks for Wall Street, getting rid of as much of, as they can of the Dodd-Frank Reform Act that took place after the 2008 crash on Wall Street. So which one do you want to talk about first, Sidney?
Let's talk about the Administrative Procedure Act, because what is occurring there is probably the thing that is least obvious to your listeners.
Go ahead.
The Administrative Procedure Act is the law that establishes the procedures and the process that government agencies, regulatory agencies, must use to establish new regulations. And the current law has been around since 1947. It's proven to be a workable model. And if anything, it is already so burdensome that it takes agencies for important and controversial regulations somewhere between 4 and 8 years in order to develop and finalize a regulation. The bill passed by the House would add 74 new procedures, including 29 new requirements for documentation. So even a conservative estimate would be it would add another 2 to 4 years to the rulemaking process. In other words, something that now takes 4 to 8 years is going to take something like 8 to 10 years or more.
So, but the hidden agenda, not so hidden here, is that they want to gum up the works with paperwork and frustrate and delay the implementation of rules.
I think that's exactly correct.
So what's going to stop them?
Well, this bill is likely to be vetoed by the president. And this is really probably a trial run for what would happen if we end up during the next presidential election with an all-Republican cast in the House, in the Senate, and a Republican president who would be likely to sign something like this.
So, in other words, with this and the evisceration of the Dodd-Frank gift to Wall Street, are the Republicans just simply forcing Obama to veto, and then they can basically say that it's Obama that's stopping the government as opposed to them, which is what the Republicans have been doing for the last 6 years?
Yes, they have a real sort of rhetorical advantage when we're talking about these kinds of regulations and procedures. So if you ask Republican leaders why we need this additional procedure or why they want to weaken some of the Dodd-Frank requirements, they're going to tell you it interferes with the economy, it's a loss of jobs. These regulations can cost millions of dollars on these companies, and they get in the way of economic progress. What is a little more difficult to understand is the costs to the economy don't go away if we don't regulate. Instead, what happens is they fall on all of us in the form of additional environmental degradation, health and safety problems, unsafe foods, on and on. And there's no better example of that, I suppose, than the collapse of Wall Street. We had this completely unregulated environment. Acting in an environment, the firms managed to take such risky behavior that they literally sank the economy. God knows how many billions of dollars of damages that cost. And those are real costs to average people like you and I and others who've been paying the price ever since. So when we evaluate how quickly and effectively we want to do regulation, we have to take into account what happens when we delay regulation as well.
Well, of course, this is a little ironic, isn't it? That on the one hand, the Republicans are getting rid of regulations that would prevent Wall Street from doing what they did in 2008. And now they've, the president's going to be forced to veto that. But in terms of these House changing the government rules to add more regulations in order to slow down the implementation of regulations, they're doing the opposite. Is there any way?
Of course, I think as you're asking, the two are linked. So on the one hand, one way to weaken the protections in Dodd-Frank is to pass new legislation, which weakens the requirements in Dodd-Frank. But another way is what they've done in the Regulatory Accountability Act, which is to add all these additional new procedural requirements, which will further slow the rulemaking process. And one of the rulemaking processes that's going to be slowed down to a crawl, it's practically there now, is at the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is largely responsible for implementing Dodd-Frank. So in some instances, they're taking away their authority to act. In other instances, they're leaving that authority, but they're going to make it much more difficult to act in terms of regulatory delay.
And Sydney, given that the only recourse to stop the Republicans, since they control the House and Senate, is a presidential veto, and in both of these bills, I think the president's promised to veto both the Dodd-Frank evisceration and this new Administrative Procedures Act that we've been talking about here. Is there anything else? Is there any way to name and shame them? I mean, it's so clear to me that these lawmakers are just the whores and hirelings of the rich and powerful who got them elected, and they're simply paying them back. And, you know, I just wonder who the hell's standing up for the American people here.
Well, the situation's a little unclear in the Senate because of the ability of the Democrats to filibuster both the Regulatory Accountability Act as well as the changes to Dodd-Frank. So the Republicans are going to have to attract some support from Democrats to get the 60 votes they need to overcome a filibuster in the Senate and actually pass this stuff out. And so the big question is, will the Democrats in the Senate hold firm and vote as a block against this bill? That did happen in the House. All but five House Democrats voted against the Regulatory Accountability Act. So if the Democrats likewise hold firm in the Senate, the matter would stop right there. Now, as you mentioned, though, the question is really political money, which is the sort of dirty secret, not so much of a secret anymore, actually, of our political system. And both parties receive lots of money, for example, from Wall Street and from other corporate concerns. And so it's a question of the extent to which Democrats might act based on campaign contributions or otherwise. I actually think they won't. This bill is so ridiculous in setting out all these requirements that I think even if one thought the administrative process needed some tinkering with, it wouldn't be this bill.
And again, I'm speaking with Sydney Shapiro, the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and the Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University. Well, but on the Wall Street evisceration of Dodd-Frank, unfortunately, a lot of Democrats on the House Banking Committee, and I imagine same is true on the Senate Banking Committee, just get showered with money from Wall Street. And since we've turned our politicians into telemarketers, where they spend more time on the phone raising money than they do doing the people's business, you know, without excusing Democrats for selling out to Wall Street, I imagine a lot of these wavering Democrats like the fact that, you know, you just get a ton of money from Wall Street and you don't have to spend all your time raising money elsewhere. Is that your understanding of why Wall Street is able to buy these Democratic lawmakers?
I actually think your prediction may well be an accurate one. If you are a Democrat and you do receive some financial support from the financial industry, it's a lot easier to defend and support these kind of pinprick amendments, which the House is passing to weaken Dodd-Frank, because you could say that overall most of the protections are still there. It's indefensible. I think that's also indefensible, but it's indefensible in the extreme to vote for the Regulatory Accountability Act, which is kind of ludicrous in being completely over the top.
And apparently only, what, five Democrats did vote for it, right?
Five Democrats did vote for it, absolutely. Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
So, but what does this say, though, about the direction of the country? I mean, these rules, and of course they take a long time, as you pointed out, to even get the rules implemented, and now they want to slow that down and gum up the works. But these rules are, as far as I can tell, are about some of the basic things that, as a society, that we need. We need to be, the environment needs to be protected from toxic substances, which are all over the place. Our food needs to, we can't be poisoned by our food. The medication we take can't kill us. I mean, what the hell is going on here?
Unfortunately, there's a long history of sort of ups and downs in this country politically. And we've had real spurts of legislative activity, largely, if not entirely, led by Democrats, that have led to protective legislation. And most of the legislation that's in place today was elected by Democratic Congresses. In between those spurts of regulation, we have had periods, such as now, where the capitalists and corporations and others with lots of money have been able to dominate the political system, not forever, but certainly for years at a time. So if you're an optimist, you could say the circle is going to come around again, and we're going to have a cycle of renewal here and get after some of these real problems that are facing our country, including, most importantly, climate change. On the other hand, if you're more pessimistic, you might say, yeah, but the equation's been changed, because with Citizens United, the Supreme Court has allowed the rich and corporations to donate literally unlimited amounts of money to the political system, a situation we've really perhaps never had before. And it's really hard to know how that's going to play out.
But, you know, the new romantics now are the libertarians. It used to be the liberals were called the dreamers, and they were the impractical ones. But now it would seem that the libertarians have these wonderful ideas about a perfect society, but they don't seem to factor in the human factor. And they have this unbridled optimism that if you just get rid of government regulations, the marketplace will take care of everything. The history indicates the opposite, doesn't it? If you don't force food manufacturers to follow safety rules and not have contaminants in the food, if you don't do the same with the drug companies, if you don't do the same with the oil companies, they'll spill and pollute, etc. I mean, where do they get this idea from that, you know, if, assuming that these Republicans are voting and the handful of Democrats are voting based on ideology as opposed to based upon the fact that they're paying back the guys that gave them money to get reelected?
Well, to be hopefully a little fair to the other side, I think it's a combination of wanting to be responsive to your constituency and your donors. And that's combined with a kind of ideological framework that really allows you to look at the world and overlook some of its most important realities, including the one about which you just spoke, which is everything in our history indicates if markets aren't subject to reasonable regulation, then one way or another they will end up harming us, and sometimes substantially harming us.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sidney Shapiro.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for asking.
And again, I've been speaking with Sidney Shapiro, who's the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and the Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University. One of the country's leading experts on administrative procedure and regulatory policy, he's written 10 books and has been a consultant to government agencies and has testified before Congress on regulatory subjects. He was a trial attorney with the Federal Trade Commission and deputy legal counsel of the Secretary's Review Panel at the U.S. Department of Health, Education and Welfare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.